The second case for oral argument this morning is Randy and Kathy Muller, appellants versus Maxine Benesch, appellee. For the appellants, we have Mr. Sander Moorhead and Ms. Christine Kreider O'Connell, attorneys from Sioux Falls. And I understand, Mr. Moorhead, you'll be doing the arguing this morning. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Very well. And for the appellee, Benesch, we have Mr. Jeffrey Cole, an attorney from Parks. The court should note that Justice Sabers has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, former justice of this court, to sit in Justice Sabers' place. Mr. Moorhead, you may proceed, sir. You have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Honorable Chief Justice, may it please the court and counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Sander Moorhead. Chris O'Connell and I appear on behalf of Randy and Kathy Muller. The facts of this case date back to 2002. In March of 2002, Kenneth Dubendorfer, an elderly gentleman from Centerville, South Dakota, asked Randy and Kathy Muller if they would serve as his attorneys in fact. They agreed to do so, and on March 30th, 2002, he executed a power of attorney instrument drafted by a local attorney named Mike McGill, granting them the powers of attorney. It's a broad general grant of powers of attorney. It's contained as Exhibit A on the Benesch's brief. For the 7 or 8 months following the grant of that power, the Mullers faithfully executed their duties, spent a considerable amount of time showing care, concern, and companionship with Mr. Dubendorfer, and also assisted him in managing his financial affairs. Mr. Dubendorfer also kept close track of his own financial affairs, and in January of 2003 was going through a number of his financial records regarding certain certificates of deposit that he had at the Alcester State Bank. This time he realized that a number of his certificates of deposit had beneficiary designations in favor of individuals with whom he'd had little contact with or who were deceased, and decided that he wanted to make changes to those designations and be in favor of his friends, Russ Jefferts, Ray Lewis, and the Mullers, in recognition of the time and effort they had given on his behalf. So on January 15th, Kenneth Dubendorfer instructed Randy Muller to go to the Alcester State Bank and make changes to various CDs. One of these was a CD that was originally designated in favor of Maxine Benesch in the amount of $40,000. He instructed Randy Muller to change the designation to $20,000 in favor of Benesch and $20,000 in favor of the Mullers. During the attempts to effectuate this transaction, discussions were had between Attorney McGill, the original drafter of the power of attorney, Lois Anderson from the Alcester State Bank, and the Mullers. And they finally came to the decision that there would need to be some sort of additional authorization beyond the power of attorney instrument to effectuate the transactions. And so on January 15th, Kenneth Dubendorfer signed a writing stating that he had discussed the nature of the transactions with Randy Muller, that he approved of the transactions, that he was referring to his power of attorney previously executed, and that he was referring to his CDs at the Alcester State Bank. After these changes were made shortly thereafter, Kenneth Dubendorfer passed away, and Benesch, disappointed that she was receiving $20,000 instead of $40,000, brought this suit asserting that there was no authorization for the transactions, that they amounted to self-dealing and therefore were constructive fraud and a breach of fiduciary duty. The Mullers proffered the January 15th writing authorizing the transactions as evidence that there was at the very least an issue of material fact with regard to whether the transactions were authorized. The trial court in this case, Your Honors, and this is the key issue the Mullers feel before the court today, the trial court announced a bright line rule that subsequent evidence, subsequent writings, oral testimony, and other circumstantial evidence is per se inadmissible with regard to interpreting a principal's intent under a power of attorney. And it is this that we feel was an error, and we request that this court reverse that decision for three reasons. First, the relationship between the Mullers and Kenneth Dubendorfer was first and foremost an agency relationship. And when agency principles are applied to the facts of this case, the writing is properly admissible to show Kenneth Dubendorfer's intent. Second, the trial court's decision strives against the great weight of authority, holding either that all of the surrounding circumstances concerning the power of attorney relationship are relevant with regard to what the principal's intent was, or at the very least, that writings are capable of expanding or otherwise altering the power of attorney relationship. Finally, Your Honor, under this court's summary judgment standard, questions of breach of fiduciary duty and fraud are questions of fact, and the only inference that can properly be drawn from the January 15th writing is that Kenneth Dubendorfer read it, understood it, and approved of it, and approved of the transactions. Your Honors, with regard to this relationship between the Molars and Kenneth Dubendorfer, it was first and foremost an agency relationship. Now, as the Maryland Supreme Court in King versus Bankard and Delaware Supreme Court in Schock noted, while powers of attorney are to be strictly construed, they must not be so strictly construed that the intention of the principal is frustrated. We urge the court that in a situation such as this, this is precisely the type of situation that was being discussed. Attorneys, in fact, are frequently trusted members, such as the Molars, who it would only be natural that the principal would want to perhaps benefit in the future also. The trial court's per se rule that no future writing, as in this case, could be admissible to show an issue of material fact would utterly frustrate any ability of a principal to do this. Second of all, Your Honor, the trial court and Ms. Benash in briefing has made extensive arguments and extensive of the fact that attorneys, in fact, are fiduciaries. However, this is the case with regard to every agency relationship, Your Honor. As noted by the Nebraska Supreme Court, however, in Crosby versus Lures, there's not just a duty of loyalty, there's also a duty of obedience. If an agent knows his principal's desires, it's his duty to not act contrary to it. The January 15th writing signed by Kenneth Dubendorfer is evidence that Kenneth Dubendorfer did in fact instruct Randy Moeller to make the changes and that he was duty bound to effect those changes.
How do we know that?
Pardon, Your Honor?
How do we know that from the writing that your client typed up? What does it say in there that gives us that kind of indication?
It unequivocally refers to the date on which the transactions were done, Your Honor. It also refers to the Alcester State Bank. Unequivocally refers that he's referring to his CDs.
What does it refer to the date?
It says January 15th.
Maybe I'm misreading. I thought it just said they wish to notify the bank that I'm fully aware of the changes to be made on the CDs that I have at the State Bank of Alcester by my power of attorney, Randall R. Moeller. We have discussed the changes and I authorize Randy Moeller to make them on my behalf. Is there something in addition to that that I don't have in front of me?
Respectfully, Your Honor, immediately following that, it says dated this 15th day of January 2000.
Okay, well, that's the date he signed it.
That's the date he signed it. It's also the date the transactions were effectuated.
Okay.
Furthermore, Your Honor, under this court's holding in In re Blair, a power of attorney relationship is different from other types of relationships such as wills and trusts in that while those remain static unless revoked, a principal has the power to change or alter or otherwise modify the scope of the fiduciary relationship. The January 15th writing is evidence that with regard to, at least to his Alcester bank accounts, Dubendorfer did precisely that and made a specific direction to the Molars to take the actions that they did.
So if I'm understanding then, that what the trial court didn't even consider this writing.
The trial court found that it was inadmissible as a matter of law, Your Honor. They found that it was not admissible to create an issue of material fact.
Had it been admissible, then you'd get by the summary judgment.
That is our contention today, Your Honor, is that this writing at the very least creates an issue of material fact because the only inference that can properly be drawn under this court's summary judgment standard is that the signer of the instrument, Kenneth Dubendorfer, read it, understood it, and approved of its contents.
So what kind of a writing would suffice to change a power of attorney or to direct the power of attorney?
We submit that this writing is sufficient, Your Honor. The cases generally fall into one of two categories. There's one line of cases, the main case of which is Shock v. Nash from the Delaware Supreme Court, also the Georgia Court of Appeals in Stewart, and also the Michigan Court of Appeals, that have followed a path of examining all of the circumstances surrounding the power of attorney, including the nature of the relationship between the parties, to determine the overall propriety of the transactions at issue. The second line of authority is a line of authority suggesting that only writings are capable of altering the scope and capable of authorizing self-interested transactions. For instance, the South Carolina Supreme Court in Fender held that we hold today that authorizations to self-deal must be in writing. Similarly, in Crosby versus Lores, the Nebraska Supreme Court held that oral authorizations will be insufficient. The Court of Claims applying California law, affirmed by the Federal Circuit Court of Appeals, specifically stated that if there had been a writing authorizing the transactions, then there would have been authority to engage in the self-interested transactions.
Now, this particular writing doesn't actually give or direct the self-dealing, does it?
Your Honor, it does not refer directly to self-dealing. However, we would urge the court that that is not necessary and is not the type of requirement that any court has sought. It does refer unequivocally to the date in question when the transactions occurred. It refers to the Alcester State Bank, refers to his CDs, states that Randy Mueller and Kenneth Dupendorfer had a discussion about the nature and extent of what those transactions were going to be. Under this court's summary judgment standard, Your Honors, we would submit that the only inference that could be properly drawn under this standard of review is that the transactions were in fact authorized.
But that's only if we reject the bright line rule, right? If we accept the trial court's determination that the bright line rule should prevail in South Dakota, then that wouldn't come in, would it?
That is correct, Your Honor. However, we would urge the court not to adopt the bright line rule espoused by the trial court in this case for one simple reason, and that is there is simply no case holding that a subsequent writing is per se inadmissible with regard to the grantor's intent. There are numerous cases holding that oral testimony is inadmissible, numerous cases holding the circumstantial evidence is inadmissible, but I am unaware, after thorough research, of a single case holding that a subsequent writing is per se inadmissible.
What, beyond that, what do you think are the negative policy reasons why we should not adopt the bright line rule?
Two reasons. First, Your Honor, the South Dakota legislature in Chapter 55.2 has obviously spoken its own policy with regard to fiduciary relationships and anticipated the possibility that there might be occasions where a fiduciary would be asked or authorized to engage in self-interested transactions. Specifically, 55.2, 3, 1, and 4 both articulate the types of authorizations that are permitted and the types of authorizations that will be effective to permit self-dealing. Your Honors, as the legislature is the articulator of policy in this state, if the legislature has seen fit to permit it, then obviously a rule which essentially makes it impossible to permit self-dealing because of the inability to authorize it orally or in writing would be in contravention of that policy. Second of all, Your Honor, as the Supreme Court of Delaware noted in Shock v. Nash, notwithstanding other policy concerns, the number one concern with a power of attorney instrument, as with a contract or a will, is the intent of the parties, or in this case, the party to the instrument. The Delaware Supreme Court indicated that a bright line rule would run grave risk of frustrating the grantor's intent. Specifically, they noted that powers of attorney are frequently drafted by somebody else. In this case, Mike McGill drafted the original power of attorney. Occasionally, things might be included or excluded, which the principal wanted either to be in the instrument or not in the instrument, and the Delaware Supreme Court envisioned a situation in which, without allowing any subsequent evidence in, there wouldn't be any ability for the principal to correct what was originally wrong without completely revoking the instrument.
What if the power of attorney expressly prohibited self-dealing? Would the subsequent writing still be admissible as to intent?
We would submit that it would, Your Honor, for two reasons under South Dakota. One under law outside the jurisdiction, one under South Dakota law. First, numerous jurisdictions, including Maryland and Delaware, have recognized that powers of attorney are to be construed in the same manner as a contract, using contract principles. Under South Dakota law, subsequent writing, subsequent oral statements, and subsequent conduct can modify the understandings of the party to a contract. So we would suggest, Your Honor, that yes, under the rationale cases such as Hofelt, a subsequent writing could certainly alter what the original understanding was. As I stated previously, Your Honor, there are two lines of authority with regard to powers of attorney. There is no third line of authority holding that there is simply no possibility to modify an instrument using a writing. In fact, one of the cases relied on extensively by both the trial court and Benash in this case is the Profka case from Wisconsin. And in that case, both in a footnote and also on later on in the opinion, that court specifically cited to the case that we cited in our brief, Estate versus Swanson, approving changing the terms of a power of attorney with a subsequent writing. So we'd urge the court that even the authority upon which the trial court relied approves admission of the evidence we seek to admit. Finally, Your Honors, admitting this writing is in line with South Dakota law. In re Blair states that a principal may modify a power of attorney. Hofelt in similar cases hold that subsequent writings may modify contractual agreements. And South Dakota Chapter 55.2, specifically 55.2-3 at sub 1, indicates that a fiduciary may in fact be involved in a self-interested transaction, provided that they've fully disclosed the nature of the transaction to their principal, provided that they've made sure that everything was done fair and above board, and that they have authorization to do so. And we submit that this writing is enough to create an issue of material fact as to whether that is what happened in this case. Consequently, Your Honor, under this court's summary judgment standard, respectfully request that this court reverse the holding because there is an issue of material fact created by this writing.
I have a procedural question. I'm not sure I understand the significance of the fraud claim. The court granted judgment on both fiduciary duty and fraud. And the focus here has primarily been on fiduciary duty. Is the trial court sustainable just on fraud, irrespective of what we rule?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor. A close reading of the court's memorandum opinion reveals that the fraud claim was actually, summary judgment was granted on grounds of constructive fraud under Chapter 55.2, SDCL 55.2, I believe 7, provides that violation of 1 through 6 amounts to constructive fraud, and that was what was found by the court in this case, was our understanding, Your Honor. What was found was not the statutory or common law fraud, but rather that articulated by Chapter 55.2. We would submit that under either the fraud or the fiduciary duty, because 55.2 is actually dealing with fiduciaries, and 55.2-3 specifically says, enumerates an exception to the general rule against self-dealing, we would assert that so long as there's an issue of material fact on that, summary judgment should be reversed on that issue as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Moorhead. Mr. Cole, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court and counsel. Today we ask you to affirm the trial court's summary judgment in this case on both of those counts, breach of fiduciary duty and fraud, because the Moellers engaged in violations of their statutorily mandated fiduciary duties. And I think there are several undisputed facts that I can summarize in about 5 points here that I think support the trial court's decision. First of all, you've got the power of attorney that's at issue here. It's included in tab 8 of the appendix to our brief that clearly does not give gifting power or the power to self-deal to the fiduciaries, in this case, the Mohlers. It's undisputed that in January of 2003, the Mohlers went to the bank, State Bank of Alcester, and the Wells Fargo Bank, for that matter, and they made a number of changes to payable on death accounts to benefit themselves. They ultimately benefited approximately $390,000 as a result of those transactions, including the $20,000 they took from my client, in this case, Mrs. Benash. These transactions were all completed using the power of attorney. If you look at tab C to the appendix, pages 7 to 20, all of those documents are the copies of the documents where the changes were made using the power of attorney that doesn't contain the power to make the changes. Now, and that's confirmed by Mr. Mohler's testimony at his deposition, which is cited in our brief. It's confirmed by the bank officer's deposition testimony cited in our brief, and again, by the actual documents themselves. It's also undisputed, and here's a key point in this case. It's undisputed that the Mohlers did not take Kenneth Dubendorfer to an attorney. They did not take him to get independent legal advice to make a full disclosure. They did not ask the attorney to come to his house to discuss these changes or draft a new power of attorney that would have specifically, in unambiguous language, included the power to self-deal. Instead, what they did is they went home and typed this document up that's in a tab B to our brief and claimed they had him sign it. Now, I understand whether he signed it or not, it's an issue of fact, and I'll concede that for the record. But that's what they did. And all these discussions that Mr. Moore had talked about, where Kenneth Dubendorfer said this or that about what he wanted, that comes entirely based upon the testimony of Randy Mohler and Kathy Mohler. It's also undisputed that when they called Mr. McGill, the attorney, he told them you can't use the power of attorney to self-deal because it would breach your fiduciary duty. That's what he testified to at his deposition. It's also clear that the law in this state is that a power of attorney relationship is a fiduciary relationship. And anything that is within the context of actions taken under that fiduciary relationship have to be exercised. These duties have to be exercised in the context of the fiduciary duty. It's not simply a contract, as Mr. Moore had indicated or tried to argue here today. And there's good policy reasons for that. And I've set those out in our brief. And I think that those are policy reasons that this court, I urge the court to examine. And they're noted by the Prafke case as far as extrinsic evidence goes. It's noted by this court's decision in Blair that power of attorney documents are to be strictly pursued and strictly construed. The Ward versus Lange case was a case where this court held that summary judgment was appropriate when someone violates statutorily mandated fiduciary duties. And finally, the State of Stevenson case, which concerned a trust, but which still basically discussed fiduciary duties and self-dealing, indicated that before that can happen, there has to be a language that's clear and unmistakable authorizing the self-dealing. The foundation of the fiduciary duty is the duty of loyalty and the duty of good faith, found in 55-2, found in this court's decisions. That's the basis or the context upon which all actions need to be examined. I submit that the court should adopt a bright line rule because of the danger of fraud that's inherent in these types of cases.
So by the bright line rule, where does that lead you to? I'm looking at this durable power of attorney, and there's a lot of general terms in here. So what if Mr. How do you pronounce his name? Dubendorfer?
Yes, Your
Honor. What if he tells them things verbally as they're going along? I want you to take my money and go out and buy a gift for my grand... I want you to buy a new car for my grandson. Or no, I guess it wouldn't be that. But my niece or nephew or something like that. What does that have to be in writing then?
I think, Your Honor, that because of the inherent danger of fraud in these types of transactions, that the power of attorney itself should govern those transactions. And this power
down,
of attorney...
Down to that specific...
I would submit it should, Your Honor, because of the inherent danger of fraud that we have in these types of cases, especially someone in Kenneth Dubendorfer's situation who was 89 years old at the time these transactions took place and was not able to take care of himself.
Yeah, but then that doesn't that then go to, if there's an allegation of self-dealing, go to the jury to make that decision?
I'm
concerned about it really binding these durable power of attorney for everything to be in writing so specifically.
That issue was addressed in a couple of those cases, the Cunha case out of Hawaii, Your Honor, and the Krafke case also. And they cited the Estate of Casey case, which is a federal circuit court case, that said that when you look at the balancing test to determine how you decide that issue, you need to look at how easy it really is to allow a principal in this case to express that intent. And the specific language in that case was by their draftsman and by the principal. So it would have been an easy matter, and I think the standard that this court sets out should be that you take the person to an attorney, that you get disinterested advice, that the document be redrafted to comprehend that alleged intent.
So is this limited to self-dealing? Is the bright line only limited to self-dealing?
I think in terms of, if I understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, giving gifts to the person who has the power of attorney. Does it only go to that kind of a scenario, or does it go to everything that is different than what's expressed in here?
No, I think it goes to self-dealing. I think that's primarily what we're looking at here because of it's the antithesis of what a fiduciary duty is. Typically, of course, the fiduciary duty is that you have to act for the best interests of the other person, of the principal, even at the cost of your own interest. And because it's the antithesis of what the foundation of the duty is, I submit that you should apply the bright line rule.
So under Justice Meyer Henry's example of going and buying a car for my niece and nephew, that would not run afoul of the bright line rule?
It may not.
Because the niece and nephew are not the holders of the power of attorney.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
But if it's not in writing and the person dies, why couldn't the rest of the heirs then challenge that?
Well, I think that there is always going to be a potential question of undue influence that could be raised under those circumstances.
But if we adopt a bright line rule, aren't we really? I'm concerned about the bright line rule. I guess
the bright line rule would apply to the fiduciary self-dealing. I think that's how we would like to see this court limit its decision because that is the danger that it's aimed at.
What if, though, it's an absolutely legitimate, above-board request to do something that he really wants done? He goes to the lawyer. Maybe they even go to the bank together with the lawyer and the Molars, and they say, this is what we want. I mean, a bright-line rule would prevent that as well, would it not?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and I would explain it or distinguish it this way. If he goes himself and he makes the gift or he makes the changes, he signs the document, he's got the power to make a gift as long as it wasn't under undue influence. If that's the case, we've got a different case here. And under the scenario that you laid out, certainly had he went to the bank with them and made the changes, it's not the power of attorney or the attorney in fact that's making the changes to the documents.
Let me change it just a little bit. What if he went to McGill and said, I want you to draft a document to approve these designations? And McGill, instead of changing the power of attorney, drafts a direction to the bank and has him sign it. And Molars aren't there. And McGill does everything he can do to ascertain intent, eliminates undue influence. is it still going to be excluded?
I think under the bright line rule, it would be excluded, Your Honor. And I think it should. I think it's a minimum price to pay or a balancing test that the court should apply in these types of cases. I would say that probably the likely scenario is that the attorney would redraft the power of attorney, which happens all the time. I've drafted powers of attorney that say I specifically give the power to self-deal.
Isn't that awfully artificial, though? If he puts up the top of the page, amended power of attorney, that's okay. But under Justice Zinner's example, where it's a direction, that's not okay. And yet this attorney is drafting both documents.
Well, I think, you know, a power of attorney can be, I don't think the title controls. I think it's the substance of the document that may control under those circumstances, Your Honor. And that also has, I think, the added benefit of if they had done that, if a fiduciary does that, they're meeting their fiduciary duty by, in fact, going and getting disinterested legal advice on that issue where there's an explanation. And you've got some evidentiary reliability under those circumstances, whereas here they didn't do that. They simply typed it up, claimed that he signed it, and claimed that they had these conversations with him. The other issue that I want to bring up here in my time is I'm going to ask the court to look at that power of attorney, what I call the note. And really what Mohlers are claiming here is that that's an amendment to the power of attorney. I think that's a fair characterization of what they've said. If that's the case, this court's Blair decision applies with equal force, and that is, does it say in clear and unmistakable language? It doesn't say kind of. Clear and unmistakable language that they can self-deal. It doesn't say that. It says he's aware of changes. It doesn't say that the changes can be made to benefit the Mohlers. It doesn't say that they can change accounts. It doesn't say any of those things that I think under Blair it should say in order for that document to have the legal effect that they say that it does. I'd like to also talk a little bit about the Shock v. Nash case that they've cited extensively. That case also says that as part of the fiduciary duty, you have to make full disclosure and get independent advice. It's undisputed in this case, Mohlers did not do that. The effect of that is it takes it out of the scenario that they've laid out, and that Shock case, I think, says that they have to do that. And if you don't do that, you don't get independent legal advice, you violated your fiduciary duties. And I think that's a fair reading of that. I think 55.2.3 sub 1 also indicates that that is what the fiduciary duty requires, to get that person independent legal advice. It's undisputed here. That's not the case, and it didn't happen. I would ask the court and urge the court to consider the ramifications of what the Mohlers did here. I submit, and I submitted in my brief, that this would actually encourage fraud, and I think that's a fair statement to make. In a case where the only people who claim to have any knowledge of the note that was drafted or this intent are the people who were benefited in the amount of $390,000 because of their self-dealing under fiduciary power. I just want to make a couple points, and then I'm gonna sit down, Your Honors. This is not a typical contract case. Even the cases that they've cited, where they say a power of attorney is a contract, those cases also say it's a fiduciary relationship. And everything that you do as a fiduciary has to be within the scope of that fiduciary relationship, those fiduciary duties. What they should have done here and what their fiduciary duties required them to do, were this the intent of Kenneth Dubendorfer, is to take him to an attorney or have an attorney visit him to ascertain his intent and to execute a new power of attorney. They didn't do that. They had been able to do that a couple of other times. Once when they had him redraft his will to their benefit, when they had this power of attorney drawn on March 30th, 2002, and once when they tried to get him to disclaim his interest in CDs that we're here in court about today. Under those circumstances, they were able to do that. And that just demonstrates the ease to which, with which, if that had been his intent, it could have been accommodated by having an attorney visit with him about that. I would conclude my remarks is that basically a quote that Justice Sabers used in the Stevenson case, which again dealt with trust, but I think is right on point here. He said, quote, "The powers," referring to fiduciary powers, "must always be used for the trust and its beneficiary, not for the trustee. That is the nature of a fiduciary relationship," end quote. And that's at page 822 of that decision. I submit that's the essence of why this case is so important, of why this court needs to think, and I believe adopt the bright line rule in this case, because you can't, as the Mollers try to do here, they can't turn the duty of obedience, the duty to obey that they claim, that may be an issue of fact if you allow some of this evidence in, they can't claim the duty of obedience should override the general fiduciary duty. That duty of obedience needs to be exercised within the context of their fiduciary duties. And I submit that they haven't done that in this case. And so on behalf of Mrs. Benash, I urge the court to adopt the bright line rule. In the alternative, I ask the court to apply the rule in Blair to that note and to find as a matter of law that it does not give the power to self-deal, and to affirm the trial court in all respects. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. Murray, do you have 10 minutes, sir?
Chief Justice, and may it please the court. With regard to the bright line rule, it's important to note what bright line rule the trial court articulated in this case. Trial court articulated that nothing, no writing, no oral testimony, nothing was admissible. And this bright line rule would be unprecedented in all of the research that I've done regarding this, Your Honor. There is simply no case holding that a subsequent writing is not admissible. As a matter of fact, one of the cases that counsel discussed, the Profka case from Wisconsin, specifically in that opinion, referred to the situation and referred to the estate of Swanson case under California law, where a power of attorney may in fact be altered even to allow self-dealing by a subsequent writing. Consequently, the authority of the trial court and the authority Benash relies upon in her brief actually is beneficial to our position. Secondly, with regard to a bright line rule that involves the requirement of an attorney consultation, 55-2-3, articulated by the legislature, contains no such requirement. When the beneficiary does have the capacity to contract, and with the full knowledge of the motives of the trustee and of all other facts concerning the transaction which might affect his own decision, and without the use of any influence on the part of the trustee, permits the trustee to do so, then a self-interested transaction is permitted. Had the legislature of South Dakota wished there to be a separate requirement in every case that people like the Mollers bring in an independent attorney, the legislature of South Dakota could have easily articulated that within the statute itself. The fact that they chose not to suggests that this court should not also impose the requirement that Benash urges today. Next, Your Honor, the bright line rule that counsel refers to has its genesis in the Casey case, which he mentioned. Casey and all of the cases that follow it, including the Aiello case cited by the appellees, the Crabtree case from Iowa, and even Stevenson in this case, Your Honor, are all similar in that in each and every one of those cases, the attorney, in fact, was attempting to ask the court, there's nothing we have that shows that self-dealing or gifting was permitted. Please imply into this instrument a power to self-deal or a power to gift. That was precisely what happened in the Stevenson case before this court, where Tamara attempted to argue that she had the power to self-deal implied. That's simply not the case that's before this court today. The Mollers are not asking this court to imply anything. The Mollers are asking this court to take a subsequent writing, which has been universally accepted as an appropriate means to alter a power of attorney, and simply apply it. And that's all that's being asked, to create an...
Is this an amendment? I mean, the point was brought up by Mr. Cole. Is this an amendment to the power of attorney?
Our position throughout the briefing, Your Honor, has been that the general power, yes, that it is. The general power of attorney was drafted and executed on May 30th, 2002, and then subsequently on January the 15th, 2003, Kenneth Dubendorfer was giving a more specific grant or specific authorization to conduct certain transactions and, in effect, modified whatever implied duty against self-dealing was in place, as is required by SDCL 55-2-3, stating that when a beneficiary has the capacity to contract, and there's been no allegation of lack of capacity in this case, with full knowledge of the motives and the facts concerning the transaction, and the January 15th writing recites that that is the case, and without any use of undue influence, and there's been no allegation of undue influence in this case, then an case in which the trustee is interested can in fact be entered into. Your Honor, all of the facts that have been discussed, all of the points that Mr. Cole has made with regard to the facts surrounding the consummation of these transactions, this should go to the weight that a jury ultimately gives this writing, not to whether it's admitted. This is a question of fact under South Dakota law, questions of breach of fiduciary duty and fraud, and whether there was a breach. Whether or not this writing provides such a clear and unmistakable, it should be a question of fact. Furthermore, Your Honor, the clear and unmistakable language he refers to from Stevenson, again, is from a case where there was an attempt to imply a power that wasn't stated within the instrument itself. We're not asking this court to imply a power. Your Honors, I'd just like to conclude by stating that this court's summary judgment standard is well settled. If there's any issue of material fact, there must be a reversal. And all inferences derived from facts, not just the facts themselves, must be viewed in a light most favorable to my clients, the Mollers. The January 15th writing creates an issue of material fact. The only proper inferences that can be drawn under this particular procedural posture is that Kenneth Dubendorfer read that instrument, intended that instrument, and intended it to be the authorization that the Mollers claim before the court today. Further, that writing is properly admitted because if South Dakota refuses to admit even a writing purporting to alter a power of attorney, South Dakota will be in a minority of one. It will be the first jurisdiction that I have found that has found that a writing cannot alter a power of attorney to permit the transactions which occurred in this case.
You know, in light of the misspellings of his own name in the writing, is that a clear and unmistakable writing when his own name isn't spelled correctly?
Respectfully, Your Honor, we would submit that that's actually a question that should again go to the weight rather than the admissibility of the evidence. We direct the court's attention to Exhibit A, the original durable power of attorney, and as we noted in our brief, the signature on the amendment on January 15th is actually far more legible than that which was affixed to the original power of attorney document of March 30th, 2002, yet there's been no allegation that the original power of attorney was somehow defective because Kenneth Dubendorfer had bad handwriting. It's actually much easier to tell whose name's being signed on the January 15th writing than it is to tell whose signature is being affixed to the March 30th, 2002 writing.
Could raise another question as to who signed it.
Pardon, Your Honor?
And couldn't that raise another issue as to which person signed it?
Respectfully, no, Your Honor, because there's been no dispute regarding whether or not Kenneth Dubendorfer signed the original power of attorney.
Because there hasn't been any pursuit of the evidence on that, has there?
There has not, Your Honor. However, the attorney who actually drafted and was present when that instrument was signed and notarized that instrument, speaking of the March 30th power of attorney.
I'm talking about the latter document that's in dispute here, the January 25. Is there any testimony other than from your client who signed it?
No, there is not.
Okay, so that would be an evidentiary question.
That would be an evidentiary question, but again, a question of fact for a jury to determine.
I understand.
An opportunity for the jury to hear our clients testify about what transpired and for a jury to make a determination as to whether or not they believe them.
I understand.
So in conclusion, Your Honor, any questions regarding the appearance of handwriting? Questions of whether or why an attorney wasn't involved. All of these are questions that should go to the weight, not the admissibility of this evidence. We request that this court remand this case so that a trial can be had and a jury can make those credibility determinations. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Morehead. The court will be in recess for 10 minutes.